Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, December 18th, 2015. Over at the DNC, the sky is burning. They're feeling the burn. Wow, it's been ages since I trotted out some bad company. The Democratic National Committee is run by a crazy lady from Florida, a member of Congress named Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And I've interviewed Debbie a few times, met her over the years, different places in Washington. And I think I talked to her at the Democratic Convention in Denver in 2008. And she is a Zionist Democrat. And she is a loyalist of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And the Obama team doesn't like her. She has been, you know, on the outs with the White House for quite some time. But as she has operated the National Committee this year in scheduling debates and in managing the internal operations, there are many people, including allies of Senator Bernie Sanders, who believe that she is using her power to favor the Clinton campaign and to try to bury the Sanders campaign. Now, the latest dust-up has gone public just in the last 24 hours, and it's a little inside. It has to do with the management of voter data files. And as you know, as the Internet has enabled the collection of detailed information on you and me and where we live and how we vote and whether we contributed money to a campaign, these databases are extremely valuable. And Team Obama really championed the use of data and the Internet to identify voters, motivate them, get them to the polls, give them the information or a T-shirt if they needed it, offer them a trip to Washington if they won a drawing. And so recently, the vendor that manages the databases and maintains firewalls so that the Clinton campaign can't see the Sanders files and vice versa, they were installing a new piece of software, a patch. And apparently for about 30 minutes, the Sanders campaign was able to see files of the Clinton campaign. Now, when you get into the he said, she said, which we will in a moment, this appears to be innocuous, and the Sanders people, once they discovered that they could see Hillary's information, reported it to the DNC and said, hey, you ought to fix this. Now, Jeff Weaver, Sanders' campaign manager, has accused the DNC of stacking the scales to help Mrs. Clinton. The DNC, he said, is actively working to undermine the Sanders campaign, and he threatened to sue the DNC if necessary. Now, as part of this, Wasserman Schultz has suspended the access to the data files by the Sanders campaign. And Wasserman Schultz on TV this morning said the Sanders campaign doesn't have anything other than bluster at the moment that they can put out there. It's as if you found the front door of a house unlocked and someone decided to go into the house and take things that didn't belong to them. Now, according to people briefed on the matter, four different usernames associated with the Sanders campaign conducted searches of the Clinton data. And a summary of audit trails of the logs show the people with the Sanders campaign searched and saved multiple files. But Josh Uretsky, who has been fired as National Data Director of the Sanders campaign, insisted in an interview today that he was trying to verify the breach, and we did so in a way that we knew would create a record that the DNC and the vendor would have access to. We deliberately did not download or take custodianship of the records. And he acknowledged that it was clear the Clinton data was being looked at, but said he was trying to assess how available the Sanders campaign information was to others. Now, a couple of thoughts come to mind here. This is similar to the back and forth between the CIA minders and the Senate staffers from the Intelligence Committee, who were there in the secret compartment at the CIA looking at CIA emails about torture. And in a constitutional crisis that has just been covered up or buried. There was a legitimate issue that it appears the CIA was breaching its agreements and spying on the Senate staffers. The other thought that comes to mind is when Bernie Sanders was being so generous in a debate a couple of months ago, when questions were being put to Hillary about her emails and about Benghazi, and Sanders said, "We're all tired of hearing about your damn emails," and he changed the subject. Well, I think that was a mistake, Bernie. As we'll see in a moment, he is attempting to rectify that, at least on the issue of Libya. But Michael Briggs, a communications aide for the Sanders campaign, says this isn't the first time that they've reported security bugs in the DNC's voter files. On more than one occasion, the vendor has dropped the firewall between the data of different Democratic campaigns, and months ago we alerted the DNC to the fact that the campaign data was being made available to other campaigns. So, this is an internal squabble. I mean, honestly, if Sanders people look at Clinton's files, those aren't voters that are likely to support Sanders. And so the utility of this information is really minor, you know, from one campaign to the other. And I see this as equivalent to the Howard Dean scream of 2004. We never know, we've never really discovered why that microphone was so hot, why the video that was released featured Dean's scream in such a blood-curdling level. But that was used to discredit him. And I feel that I can't point fingers. I don't know if the Clinton campaign engineered this or it's just Debbie Wasserman Schultz doing what she considers to be her duty. But this is an underhanded, dirty trick. And it comes at a time that Sanders just claimed 2 million different donors to his campaign. He reached that mark this week. He got a big endorsement from the CWA, the Communications Workers of America. And they're going into a debate that nobody will watch tomorrow night. Saturday night, it's opposite an NFL primetime game. And who scheduled it there? Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So the way to advantage Hillary Clinton is to bury these debates, put them on at times when nobody's likely to be watching. And then we just get one or two sound bites the next day and we all move on, right? Well, in an interview with the Guardian newspaper from London, Bernie Sanders has accused Hillary Clinton of encouraging Islamic extremism in Libya. And it's about time. As you know, if you're a regular listener here, you've probably gotten tired of me saying, you know, Benghazi was a trivial matter overall. The big picture is, why did Hillary Rodham Clinton cheerlead the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya with no replacement in sight? And then she bragged about it. We came, we saw, he died, something like that. She thought that was funny. Well, this was the most serious foreign policy blunder of the Obama administration. The president deserves the most blame for it. But right next to him in the blame game is Hillary Rodham Clinton. And so Bernie said, regime change without worrying about what happens the day after you get rid of the dictator does not make a lot of sense. I voted against the war in Iraq. Secretary Clinton voted for it. She was proud to have been involved in regime change in Libya with Gaddafi without worrying, I think, about what happened the day after and the kind of instability and the rise of ISIS that we have seen in Libya. Now, I have a little issue about just how much ISIS has risen in Libya, but we'll save that for another day. He said, sometimes in our country, especially among our Republican friends who suffer from amnesia, we forget what happened yesterday. I can remember like it was yesterday when we had a tough president, George W. Bush, and his vice president was even tougher. So tough. And they went into Iraq, man, and they got rid of Saddam Hussein, terrible guy. But they forgot to be thinking about what happens the day after you get rid of Saddam Hussein. What has happened in that region, as everybody knows, is there's a massive instability, human tragedies beyond belief. In terms of people in that region, in terms of American soldiers, there's PTSD, traumatic brain injury, 6,700 dying. So I support and applaud Sanders. He doesn't need to attack Hillary Clinton. As a female candidate, it's very risky for an older male to do that. But as he does, he can just sharpen the way he presents their differences. And he should be asking her to justify the positions that she took and she maintains about the huge, bungled policy issue related to good old Libya. Well, in San Bernardino, we're getting more information because Enrique Marquez was charged yesterday by the federal government with purchasing the rifles that we're told were used by Farouk and his wife Malik to shoot up the Inland Regional Center, where 14 people died and 21 were wounded. My friend and colleague from Vice News, Jason Leopold, who was in San Bernardino on the day of the attacks on December 2nd, wrote this most recent story. And I have to say that while it adds interesting information, we learn about Marquez, the Walmart guy. He'd been fired by Walmart. He also converted to Islam, but continued to consume alcohol. He was a doorman at a bar in Riverside where he was regularly seen drinking. And, of course, that's a no-no if you are a Muslim. And on December 2nd, he first, we're told, confessed to a 9/11 operator who he called and admitted that his neighbor did the San Bernardino shooting. The fucking asshole used my gun in the shooting, we're told in a transcript from the 9/11 call. And he actually identified Farouk by name. He apparently told the dispatch operator he was suicidal, and then he checked into a hospital after drinking 9 bottles of beer and was referred to the psychiatric ward. Now, we're told that he also has given very detailed confessions about a plot that he and Farouk hatched a few years back, where they were going to attack a community college, and then their second assault was going to be on a local freeway. The FBI affidavit says that Marquez was introduced to Islam by Farouk in 2005, when he would have been 14 years old. And we're told he did convert to Islam at about the age of 17. Now, in Leopold's story, he adds a little detail about the Facebook posts and the other messages that I've been raising so many questions about. And Leopold writes, "The allegations imply that Farouk was radicalized long before he met his wife. FBI Director Comey said on Thursday that Malik and Farouk exchanged private messages about their joint commitment to jihad and martyrdom. According to the complaint, at 8:43 or 8:47 Pacific time, that's a.m., on the day of the shooting, a person identified as Malik searched social media for materials related to the Islamic State. A couple of hours later, and we'll delve into a New York Times account here in a moment, but they placed the time at 11:14 a.m., a post was made on a Facebook page, quote, associated with Malik, containing this pledge of allegiance, a bayat, to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of Daesh. Now, I have problems with this, as you know. And this is also rippling, having a rippling effect and undermining the credibility of the New York Times. So let's turn to their account in Friday's paper of the Enrique Marquez indictment. And in the front page section of it, they recap the events, saying that Farouk began drawing ideas from groups like Al-Qaeda, the Shabab, and eventually the Islamic State, to which his wife declared allegiance the morning of the attack. No proof is offered of that. It is simply an assertion. We have never seen the Facebook post attributed to Malik. And the Times adds this little tidbit at the very end of the story, after you go into the interior of the paper. It says, at 11:14 a.m., a Facebook post on a page associated with Malik pledged allegiance to the leader of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Now, what is a page associated with Malik? And why is this so murky? Why can't we see that post? Why can't we see how she did it? I've pointed out that we're told that they had destroyed their smartphones and she had a burner phone that did not provide for internet access. So what did they do? Leave the Inland Center and go to a public library? Did they go to a Starbucks? We don't know. And these details, for me, are infuriating. And yesterday I noted that I had not been able to find any correction or acknowledgement by the New York Times that it fucked up big time on this story. And in Sunday's paper on the front page, it repeated the assertion attributed to anonymous government sources that Malik had talked openly on social media about her support for violent jihad. So today there is not a correction, but an editor's note on page 2 of the print edition of the New York Times. I'll read it to you. A front page article on Sunday, based on accounts from law enforcement officials, reported, and they should say anonymous accounts, reported that before entering the United States, Tashfeen Malik had talked openly on social media about her support for violent jihad. On Wednesday, however, the FBI director, James Comey, said that online communications about jihad by Malik and her husband, Farouk, involved direct private messages. His remarks indicated that the comments about jihad were not made in a widely accessible social media post. Law enforcement officials subsequently told the Times that Ms. Farouk communicated with her husband in emails and private messages and on a dating site. Those are not Facebook posts. And the final lines here reads, Ms. Malik's comments about violent jihad were made on a messaging platform with Mr. Farouk, officials said. But neither Comey nor other officials identified the specific platforms that were used. And the Times did not express any regret for screwing this up. But its public editor, Margaret Sullivan, in an online article posted at the New York Times website today, lowers the boom. She says mistakes are bound to happen. Some are worse than others. This was a bad one. It involved a failure of sufficient skepticism at every level of the reporting and editing process, especially since the story in question relied on anonymous government sources, as too many Times articles do. And then she goes through what I just related to you, the history of this, and she writes, "It was certainly damning, and it was wrong." On Wednesday, the FBI director referred to such reporting as a garble. And it turns out that Malik had not posted openly on social media. She had written emails, private messages on a social media app, not visible to the public. And she had written on a dating site. In other words, the story's clear implication that those who vetted Malik's visa had missed the boat was based on a false premise. So then Margaret Sullivan talks to the people involved, notes what I did yesterday, that Mother Jones Magazine had called out Michael Schmidt and Matt Apuzzo, not only for this story, but for a false story they wrote about Hillary Clinton being the target of a criminal investigation by the Justice Department about her emails that was published in July. So she went to Dean Baquet, and I know the history of Dean Baquet. He was at the L.A. Times when he spiked the information that was delivered to them about the domestic telephone interception program, the surveillance program at the Folsom Street switch here in San Francisco. Dean Baquet went on to the Washington Post and then became the top editor at the New York Times. He said, "This was a really big mistake. Duh. And more than anything since I've become editor, it makes me think we need to do something about how we handle anonymous sources. Double duh." And Sullivan says, "I asked him why reporters or editors had not insisted on seeing or reading the social media posts in question. Duh! Or even having them read aloud to them." He told me he thought that this would have been unrealistic under the circumstances. Now, this is bullshit. They should not be going with a story when they haven't seen the information that they are relaying. And they can't rely on anonymous government sources. Baquet rejected the idea that the sources had a political agenda. He said, "There's no reason to think that's the case." Well, there are a lot of reasons to think that's the case. This event in San Bernardino is being used to justify amped up military responses, more domestic surveillance, more fear of Muslims, a tax on Muslims? And so the motivation of the people who supplied this information, which was false, needs to be explored, and the Times has a responsibility not to report information that it can't prove. Meanwhile, crimes against Muslims, hate crimes, have tripled since December 2nd. In recent years, we've had an average of about 12 suspected hate crimes against Muslims per month in the United States, but it's up to 38 in the period since the November 13th attacks in Paris. And this is a very interesting turnabout. Following San Bernardino, President Obama tried to exploit this tragedy by calling for a ban on gun sales to people whose names are on a no-fly list or a terrorist watch list. And I've explained how this may seem sensible. But the no-fly list and the terrorist watch lists are secret. Nobody knows how names get on them, and it's virtually impossible to get your name removed once it's there. And to cement this element of the police state into place, in response to this event, where, for example, we have no indication that Farouk or Malik would have been on these lists and therefore blocked from buying a gun, and they got Enrique to buy it for them anyway. So who are we kidding? But Chris Christie, the big fat governor of New Jersey who's polling at 3% in the Republican presidential primary, maybe he's up to 5 now, he signed a law yesterday banning the people of New Jersey from buying a firearm if their name is on that list. And of course, the list is secret. You can't see it. And while, you know, I understand that you probably say, Peter, look, if they're on that list, they shouldn't be buying guns, even if they were put on the list improperly. Well, it's just part of the slippery slope where the police state keeps creeping larger and larger, more invasive, more intrusive, and we accept it. Now, here's an interesting play on the current state of the minds of Americans, particularly Republicans, because a Democratic polling firm called Public Policy Polling asked a group of Republican voters if they would support bombing the city of Agrabah. And 30% said yes. Agrabah is a town in the cartoon movie Aladdin. But we'll go get him. Yeah, we'll rouse those Muslims. In Brazil, WhatsApp, which is a popular service, I have it on my phone. I use it to talk to my friends in Brazil. It's a texting and phone service that doesn't use the phone company. It uses your data time on the internet. You need web access to use it. Well, WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, and WhatsApp includes encryption so that you can send text messages or make a phone call, and it cannot be intercepted. A judge in São Paulo, Brazil, ordered telecommunications carriers to block WhatsApp for 48 hours because the company did not comply with requests to wiretap some suspects in a drug case in Brazil. And Mark Zuckerberg came out of his paternity leave to manage this crisis, apparently, and in short order, an appeals court judge countermanded that and restored the service. But WhatsApp has said that they can't intercept. They cannot monitor the communications of their users. And that's an interesting battle. It will likely play out in the United States at some time in our future. Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Carla Mahoney, who just took out another subscription. We've got Joe Carson, who sent me a nice little Christmas gift. Richard Knight just renewed his annual subscription. And Andy Krieger kicks in $10 a month. And let's not forget Annette McManus. She's on my list here today, too. So I want to thank those people who support me and encourage you. It is the season, right? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button. Then you choose Become a Subscriber. On the next page, you can pick $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. You can send me a one-time contribution via PayPal. Or if you're allergic to PayPal, you can send me a check or money order to the P.O. box that's listed on that page. However you decide to help me, I really appreciate it. And I wish you a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, whatever floats your boat. Well, I want to run through here briefly a list of positive developments in the world today. And this is a little bit stunning and maybe counterintuitive. But here's the headline: Two parliaments in Libya sign a pact for unity. The parliament that claims to represent Tripoli and a Muslim group have signed a what is described as an historic deal in Morocco, which we're hoping will lead to some sort of reconciliation in Libya. Now, that's not all. It's been announced that Israel and Turkey are very close to a deal to restore their fractured diplomatic relations, which were cut off after Israel attacked the Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, which was attempting 5 years ago to bust through the blockade of the Gaza Strip. And 9 people were killed at the time, a 10th died later. One of those 9 people was a dual U.S.-Turkish citizen. And Israel is planning to set up a compensation fund, we're told, of $20 million for the families of the victims, and Turkey will drop criminal charges that it filed. So that's an interesting rapprochement. Here comes Vladimir Putin, who gave his year-end news conference and said he wants improved ties with Washington. Commenting on relations between Moscow and Washington, he said Russia supports a U.S.-drafted Security Council resolution on settling the Syrian crisis. In general, we like it. Wow. Now, that deal has cleared the Security Council. It unanimously adopted the resolution intended to disrupt revenue headed for the Islamic State. And that's not all, friends. Iran, part of the Axis is evil, has reached out through its foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who is calling on the U.S. and Britain to join hands with Tehran in a common effort to defeat the Islamic State and end the war in Syria. Now, that's all good news, and it feels good, doesn't it? But without lowering the boom too much, I have linked to the latest commentary by our friend Gareth Porter, entitled Why the U.S. Pushes an Illusory Syrian Peace Process. And he notes that Russia is openly contesting the U.S. plan for a negotiated settlement because we keep demanding that Bashar al-Assad must step down. And Russia says that is an illegitimate demand. So at the latest peace talks, we trotted out a group of rebels called Ahrar, A-H-R-A-R, Ahrar, Ahrar al-Sham. And they came to the conference. But they said that they called for the overthrow of the Assad regime with all its pillars and symbols and handing them over for a fair trial. Now, the U.S. likes that because it supports our position. But, as Porter points out, Ahrar al-Sham wants to see an end to the Assad government and an end to a secular state government with or without Assad. Now, that gets a little complicated for the Western position, right? So we like them when they say get rid of Assad, but then their plan for the day after doesn't quite match with U.S. intentions. And so Gareth Porter concludes, the obvious implication of these facts is that the push for a ceasefire and peace negotiations is a useful device for managing the political optics associated with Syria during Obama's final year. If it is not questioned by media and political elites, the administration will be able to claim both that it's insisting on getting rid of Assad and at the same time moving toward a ceasefire and political settlement. In my weekly podcast for Boiling Frogs Post called Processing Distortion, I have a heartfelt conversation with a former drone warrior. His name is Sean Westmoreland. He helped set up the communication system that helped control drones over Afghanistan and Pakistan. And as you'll hear in this excerpt, it really left him as an almost broken man.
Well, right now I'm coping. I'm on a bunch of medication they gave me. I actually wasn't doing too well back in October. and I actually admitted myself to a ward at the Veterans Hospital. And mostly up until then, it's been, you know, kind of a profound sense of responsibility and let's say sadness, guilt, and regret, and you know, I mean, I've been having these nightmares ever since I, you know, since that day essentially, where we would be bombing villages, and I would be trying to save people on the ground, and I wouldn't be able to, and I'd know it was my fault. I guess I'm working in a ski resort, which is okay sometimes. Sometimes they do exploding for avalanches, and
it's
hair raising. Coping just one day at a time.
Yeah. You can hear the full conversation with Sean Westmoreland about America's drone program. It's wide-ranging, and it's based on his sometimes halting stream of consciousness. But I think you'll find it a very instructive and personal response to America's expansive and expanding drone program. And finally today, President Obama, who's been extremely stingy with his unrestricted pardon power, has announced just before he leaves for his Hawaiian holiday in Kailua on the island of Oahu that he is commuting the sentences of 95 federal prisoners and is granting 2 pardons. Now, there's a lot of injustice out there, and the president knows it. And I'm glad that he's pushed for sentencing reform, and these 95 prisoners are on top of, what, 45 other or so that he commuted earlier this year. But there are thousands in the pipeline. And he's got a year to go. He doesn't only have the power to pardon at Christmas time or in the last minutes of a presidential administration. But he has been extremely stingy. And there is injustice in almost every corner of our country that deserves his attention and deserves the stroke of his pardon pen. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's free, and you're free to share it with absolutely everyone. So what's holding you back, man? I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.